In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
After the holidays, a little cash goes a long way. The Chime checking account has tons of benefits to help, like fee-free overdraft up to $200 for eligible members, no monthly fees, and thousands of fee-free ATMs. You can even get paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. Sign up for Chime today at chime.com/goals24.
Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal fees may apply. Access to direct deposits up to 2 days early depends on the timing of the submission of the payment file from the payer.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, we're bringing you more on Britain's most famous prehistoric monument, Stonehenge. This episode is the second part of a two-part special on Stonehenge. So if you haven't heard part one, I'd recommend pausing this podcast now and going back to last Sunday and checking out the first part. But if you are up to date and keen for more, then in this episode, our content director, David Musgrove, put more of your top questions and internet searches about Stonehenge to the archaeologist and author Mike Pitts.
Carl O'Doherty would love to get an overview of the construction, he asked, and he talks about sort of specifically the maths and measurements needed, which is an interesting turn of phrase, isn't it? Maths and measurements. What does that tell us about? I mean, presumably, you know, they weren't using maths in the same way that we are today, or were they?
Well, I mean, not in the same way, but they must have been using maths. I mean, they must have had a counting system. I mean, one of the obvious things at Stonehenge, I mean, is the original stone circle has 56 stones in it. 56 doesn't sound very special to us today. But the final Stonehenge has a lot of tens and fives in it. You've got 30 stones in the circle, 30 lintels. You've got five trilithons in the middle and so on, which gives you 10 uprights. And you can see those fives and tens reflected in timber structures as well at the time. So clearly they could count. And to be honest, you're not going to be able to build something like Stonehenge with all the complex engineering if you can't count. And presumably they had also a system of measurement. Again, you need to measure stuff somehow to get all these things to fit together. There've been a lot of attempts to prove the existence of a unit of measurement and to try and determine exactly what that was. I don't find any of them convincing. And I think the problem for us today is that if they had any literal rulers, they would have been in material that hasn't survived. And looking for those units in the really partial, fragmented remains that we do have to look at, I just think is a lost cause. But they must have been able to count, and they must have been able to measure. And also, they must have been able to level. Stonehenge site slopes. It's not great, but it does slope enough to make it necessary to vary the height of standing stones if you are going to achieve a perfectly level ring of lintels, and that level was achieved. In terms of numbers, when I was writing how to build Stonehenge, an obvious thing I had to do was think very carefully about how long this took, how many people were involved, how many miles and how many tons and so on. And these are figures that have been puzzled over for generations. The bottom line, of course, is that we're largely guessing. We're helped with the weights by a recent laser survey of the megaliths, which allowed for the first time for a decent mathematical estimate to be made of stone weights. It's not complete because that only measures the stones above ground, and there's obviously quite a lot of stone below ground. And unfortunately, every megalith that's been excavated seems to have a different amount of stone below ground, so you can't really assume much about what we don't know underground. But I reckon my estimate is that the whole monument, the big sarsens, is the equivalent, or would have been when complete, the equivalent in weight of 12 adult blue whales. That's a huge weight. Now, it's interesting, by comparison, the blue stones are less than 1.5 whales. So that puts in perspective the difference in scale between the Sarsen monument and the blue stones. We hear a lot about the blue stones and the journey from Wales, and undoubtedly that's a challenge. But the sheer scale, the weight of the Sarsens, it brings a very different challenge when it comes to moving them. And I think to move Sarsens, unlike blue stones, we need not just engineered sledges, but we need a permanent trackway. We've got 75 Sarsens to bring to the site. Some of those are really big. You know, they're weighing 30 or 40 tons. And moving those even 5 miles, let's just leave aside where they came from a moment, is going to make a mark on the landscape in terms of just destroying the turf and making a mess. And you've got so many of these to move. I think the realistic solution has to involve a permanent track. Now, we know from archaeology that at this time people were building wooden tracks for pedestrian use. And they're all, you know, wherever we've got waterlogged remains in the UK, we find these trackways. And some of them are quite well engineered. So it doesn't take a great stretch of imagination from there and think about the houses that people were building to believe that people could have quite easily built engineered trackways that would have carried sledges. And so when you've done that, moving those huge stones, once you've built those sledges and you've built those tracks or that track, then moving those stones becomes a relatively simple task. I say relatively, but I think you could have got the stones. Okay, we'll say the Sarsens come from 17 miles or so to the north. You could have brought those to Stonehenge in less than a year, with 1,000 people working a number of different teams. And even if you say, we've got a lot of partying, we've got a lot of accidents, people are going off to do whatever they do at home, they need to do, they take part in feasts and rituals and so on, that you could easily, I think, do that in 2 years. And previous estimates have involved 10, 20 years. You know, I think we start to get to the point where it stretches beyond credibility that you could actually sustain such a project if it takes so long.
I very much like your new standard unit of measurement in Wales. I mean, normally we measure things in football pitches, don't we? But blue whales.
Yeah, well, they didn't have football pitches in the Neolithic, but they did have blue whales. I think the scale of these Sarsens is something I will keep hammering on about. It makes a massive difference to the organisation required, the labour, the technology, and so on. And the Sarsen structure is by far the bigger achievement. Not least because of the engineering, it clearly needed to be done over a relatively short period.
Okay, yeah, okay, that's I get the message. So even though the blue stones are coming from further away, actually the Sarsen movement is a big enough. Now, we need to charge on because we've still got a bit of ground to cover. So you've just mentioned there that the Sarsens probably came from the local area, not too far away. We've got a couple of questions here which ask about the local area and the landscape. We've got one from Tracy F. on Twitter who asked about Woodhenge. You mentioned Woodhenge earlier, I think, another site nearby. Shane Batt on Facebook asked what the relationship was there, if any, between the Amesbury Archer and Stonehenge. And you've mentioned there are various other sites, prehistoric sites within this landscape. So perhaps just give us a little taste of how Stonehenge fits into the broader picture there.
Until archaeologists got onto the scene, everybody thought Stonehenge just stood on its own in this sort of empty landscape. In the past decade or so, we've realised that's extremely misleading. It's a really active landscape. The first monument really to come to light was in the 1920s, and remarkably was an arrangement of rings of post holes of massive pits in the ground that had held oak posts that very similar in plan, both in scale and in arrangement, to the stones at Stonehenge. The only difference being that at Stonehenge you've got these kind of horseshoe, these open U's. At this monument, this timber monument, which the archaeologists dubbed Woodhenge, you've got complete ovals, complete rings. And unfortunately, we don't know exactly when Woodhenge was built. We know it's around about the same time. The artifacts that come out of the post holes are broadly contemporary with those we find in Stonehenge and other monuments of this period. But when we're talking, as we are now able to do, about almost periods by the decade, then we cannot say at the moment whether Woodhenge was built before, during or after the construction of the Sarsen Stonehenge, but it's around about the same time. And unfortunately, this goes with so many other things. So in terms of actually managing, you know, picturing a kind of landscape where different monuments are bouncing off each other, it's difficult to know what was going on. So, for example, I mean, one suggestion I make in my book is that if you think about the construction of this Sarsen monument involving trackways and sledges, and of course you need a lot of timber to manoeuvre the stones into position on site, then when you're done, you've got a huge amount of oak. And this oak is endowed with, I think, with rather special values because of its association with this construction project. And what do you do with it? Well, one of the things you could do with it is build something like Woodhenge. So one possibility is that Woodhenge is actually a byproduct of Stonehenge and is almost exactly contemporary with it just a few years later. And so Woodhenge then becomes a memorialization of that construction project. It's just completely hypothetical, really. Amesbury Archer is a really interesting guy. Now, he, just to remind people, was an individual who was born in Central Europe. He died, or at least he was buried. We don't know where he died, I suppose, but he was buried close to Stonehenge in Wiltshire. And at the time he was buried, he took with him a massive collection of really precious artifacts. He was greedy. Or the people who buried him wanted to betray him in that way, wanted to betray him as somebody who had power and ownership in the way that almost nobody else at the time had. And amongst that power is smithing. He has in his grave some of the oldest copper and gold in Britain. And he has too much of it. I mean, he's got enough stuff for several people of every type. He's got enough pots for half a dozen people, usually. People at this time, when they're buried with the pots, they get one. This guy's got six or seven. The distinctive pots this man is buried with, and he's got so many, there's enough there for several people, we know as beakers. And he's one of the early migrants into Britain at this time of huge cultural change across the whole of the British Isles. Now, the fact that this unique burial is found so close to Stonehenge cannot be coincidence. What's interesting, amongst many things, is that Stonehenge is west of the River Avon and the Amesbury Archer is east of the River Avon. And that may be significant because everything at the moment we know about Stonehenge in monumental terms, the monument itself, associated earthworks, Woodhenge, Durrington Walls, a massive henge immediately by Woodhenge, where at one stage it looks as if over 1,000 people were camped at the time Stonehenge was being built, and so on, are all west of the River Avon, and the Amesbury Archer is the other side of the river. If you think the river is a territorial boundary, then he's in a different political landscape. If you think the river flows through the centre of it, then he's in that landscape, but he's making a point, or at least the people who buried him are making a point, that he is not at Stonehenge. He died around 2300 BC. That's two centuries after the Saxon Stonehenge was built. So he had nothing to do with its construction. By that time, it's possible even the first megalith or two have fallen over. So he is there at a time when Stonehenge is already beginning to be reinvented by new communities. New religious ideas are entering the landscape on a large scale. What's interesting about burials at Stonehenge is that before that big Saxon monument was built, it was a very busy cemetery for cremations. That cremation burial ceased when the Saxons were erected, but one person was buried afterwards. And like the Amesbury Archer, he has, within his grave, he had these very distinctive flint arrowheads that are associated with these migrants. The Amesbury Archer, being a greedy chap, had 18 of these beautiful arrowheads in his grave. The guy at Stonehenge had three. Even three is quite a few. But what's interesting is that the man at Stonehenge did not have these arrowheads because he was showing off his ability as an archer or his wealth, but because the arrows killed him. A couple of his bones have the flint tips off arrowheads in them. One of them actually fits onto one of the three arrowheads in the grave. The other two tips of the arrowheads are both missing. He has, in addition, four wounds caused by arrows elsewhere on his body. And it's a curious thing because it looks like he didn't just die by accident. He didn't just get an arrow when he was out hunting deer or something. He's shot at from close range from all directions. So there's a really strange thing going on there. He died around about 2300 BC, which is around about the same time as the Amesbury Archer. So they're broadly contemporary, but our dating is not precise enough that we can say that either of them were actually alive at the same time. So we can't say, for example, we could hypothesize that the Amesbury Archer shot him. I mean, it's perfectly possible. But there's something funny going on here that we've yet to get to the bottom of. And we need a lot more evidence from the area and from the rest of the UK to assess what's happening socially and politically at this time. But there's a story there.
That's a good mystery to come back to at some point. Let's have a think about Stonehenge versus other monuments. Brendan Mitchell on Facebook and Blake Johnson on Facebook both asking similar sort of questions, wanting to know how unique Stonehenge is as a monument and how it compares to other similar types of monument in the landscape.
I think when people came to Stonehenge when it was an active site and hadn't seen it before, and they would have heard stories about it, and when they got close to it and saw it, they would have, I think, have been as impressed as we are today. They knew about megaliths. They knew about standing stones and stone circles. Britain in particular has hundreds and hundreds of these things all over the place. What's different about Stonehenge is, to start with, that it shouldn't be there. Stone circles and standing stones are usually in parts of the landscape where the rocks occur naturally. You can take a natural boulder of more or less the right shape to make a megalith off an outcrop, move it a few hundred yards, don't have to do anything to it, just dig a hot pit and stand it up and you're done. And that is what most of the stone circles and standing stones in Britain are. At Stonehenge, at the site, there just are not the stones to make the monument. And as we know, a lot of them came from Wales, others came from 20, 30 miles to the north in Wiltshire. So that it's not a monument, as it were, in its natural habitat. The second thing about it is the way the stone's dressed. Most megalithic monuments across Northern Europe at this time are natural boulders. Quite a few of them have been adjusted, if you like. Surfaces have been smoothed off. Sometimes carvings, abstract engravings have been set, laid into the surface of the stone, sometimes quite elaborately. At Stonehenge, we don't, during the construction phase, the original Stonehenge, we don't have anything like that because the stone is so very, very hard. But what we do have, and this is unique, is that not only are some of the stones smooth to make one surface even, all the sarsens, all the significant bluestones are carved, are smooth on almost every surface. There's very little undressed stone at Stonehenge. And the big sarsen monument, the stones are shaped very carefully. So, for example, the lintels in the ring on the sarsen circle, these 30 lintels forming a perfect circle, the lintels themselves are shaped to reflect that ring. So the inner edges are curved in and the outer edges are curved out. And they are jointed into each other. They have tongue and grooves that fit into each other. And on the undersides, they each have a pair of holes into which tenons from the top of the standing stones underneath fit. There is nothing like that anywhere in Europe. And we can only conceive that the idea came from timber engineering, that it was something that people were doing, had developed and were used to doing with timber structures that superficially looked similar to Stonehenge.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
It is absolutely true that this has long been a feature of Stonehenge history and archaeology. And not just Stonehenge, of course, but, you know, the same thing happens with Easter Island, with pyramids and so on. And it fundamentally, it's patronising and insulting, not just to ancient people, but I would argue also to modern people.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Now then, let's move on to more recent history of the monument a bit. Got a good one here from nearly breathless Nick, who asks, what did the Romans think of Stonehenge?
Who knows? If only they were here, we could ask them. It'd be really interesting, wouldn't it? One of the curious facts about Stonehenge is there's actually more Roman pottery than there is Neolithic. So we know Roman people were there, or at least, you know, Britons were there in Roman times, possibly doing no more than having the odd picnic, going along with a jar, possibly doing more than that. I mean, it has been suggested in the past that one of the reasons Stonehenge looks as dilapidated as it is today is that Romans attacked it. They saw it as a pagan monument associated with Druids and that they had a kind of war against Druidry, and knocking down Stonehenge would be a great symbolic act to show their power over native religion that they wanted to wipe out. That doesn't really stack up for all sorts of reasons. One is that the archaeological evidence that Romans did anything like that just doesn't exist. Although, to be honest, it's difficult to know exactly what you might find to prove, what you could find to prove it, but it's not there. But more importantly, we've got no indication that this was a Roman approach to native religions. Across Europe, what tended to happen is that local religious sites, local religious traditions were adopted and merged with Roman beliefs. And they were they worked with indigenous communities in that sense in really quite clever way. It's one of the reasons why the empire was so successful. We also need to remember that when Romans came to Britain, Stonehenge was already a ruin. There's no evidence at all that it was an active religious site. So in a sense, a Roman seeing Stonehenge might well have thought much the same that we might think today and look at it and think, what the hell is this? You know, no Roman soldier would have seen anything like Stonehenge any more than we do today.
And you mentioned Druids just then, which leads me nicely onto a rather droll comment from the popular medieval historian Mark Morris, who asked on Twitter, the Druids, who were they and what were they doing? I suspect what he's being a bit tongue-in-cheek there, but there is this link between Stonehenge and Druidry. So you just alluded to it then. So where does it come from and is there anything at all to it?
Druidry is quite a big camp. The link with Stonehenge has got nothing to do with the Druids that were described by Caesar, whoever they were, the kind of religious elite of late prehistoric Britain. The Druids at Stonehenge were really conjured by William Stukeley in particular. He wasn't the first, but he was the one who really made that association and embraced it in his personal life, as well as in his writings. And this was a kind of imaginary ancient people, drawing, of course, on the classical literature description of Druids, but substantially enlarged with notions of community and ceremonies and so on, and then attaching that to Stonehenge. At the time William Stukeley in the 18th century was writing, there was a kind of logic to that because they had no concept of a prehistory that reached back far beyond the Roman invasion. And if Roman writers wrote about native Britons, then it was perfectly logical to think that anything you might see in the landscape that we can't explain as being built by Romans or people who came later would have been built by the people that the Romans saw who were already there. And their religious elite were Druids, ergo Druids worshipped at Stonehenge. Archaeology breaks that up, but we're left with the Druids that Stukeley created in his own life and who became particularly active towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the last century. History is a little bit cloudy on exactly when the first modern Druid ceremony took place at Stonehenge, but it's certainly been happening a long time. And they've been gathering at Stonehenge at midsummer to witness the rising sun. And I first saw that when I just after I'd left school and I was working on an excavation in Essex, and with a bunch of friends, we drove down to Stonehenge in my beaten-up Mini. And we slept overnight nearby, and we got out and we talked to Druids and we wandered around the stones, and people were sitting there sort of making little bonfires and things, and it was all very friendly and chatty. And it's quite, of course, things are different now, but, you know, they are ineradically associated with Stonehenge, but this is the modern Stonehenge, and my goodness, the modern Stonehenge is another pile of books. There's so much there going on.
Before we get on to modern Stonehenge, we will tackle very briefly. Joseph Keyes on Twitter wants to know, is it true that no one really noticed Stonehenge was there until the 17th century, asking about whether it was robbed out and used for buildings nearby? Did it fall into sort of ignominy for a period, or were people always talking about it?
As long as we have recorded history, more or less, I think people were talking about it, and presumably they were before then. I mean, the first record we have to Stonehenge is in the 12th century AD, around about 1130. A bloke called Henry of Huntingdon wrote about Stonehenge and said, what an incredible thing it is. I can't imagine how anybody could build it or where it came from. And we've got a couple of 14th century drawings of Stonehenge, one in Cambridge University Library and one in the British Library. And in France, there's a third drawing of Stonehenge done in about 1440. So we know people saw Stonehenge back in medieval times and recognised it as something that was inexplicable. And to be honest, I think it'd be quite reasonable to imagine that people always talked about Stonehenge since it was built. So it would start off by people remembering having taken place in its construction, presumably boasting about it to their grandchildren. And then as things changed about the new reinventions and imaginations of the monument, we've got in the Bronze Age, people are carving, making surface carvings. They've got metal tools and stone to help them, of little axe heads all over some of the stones. And in Anglo-Saxon times, we got all sorts of archaeological evidence that people were at the monument almost throughout prehistory and history up to the present day. I don't think it was ever forgotten.
Yeah, those little axe heads are good, aren't they? Carved into the stones. If you can actually get into the inner sanctum to have a look at them, which is hard these days.
They're really difficult to see. I know this is not something that many of us can do, but the best way to see this axis is to go on a very dark night when it's dry with a torch and just play around with light. And there are these shallow carvings, and there are dozens of them on some stones on the eastern side of the monument looking out across the plain. And quite weird things. One of the things that's interesting is that we sometimes find the actual axes, metal axes like this, in graves. And so one wonders if this association of the monument with burial is continuing into the Bronze Age, but is represented symbolically by these carvings.
Okay, just a few more. One from Richard Tracy. Who first called the monument Stonehenge? And while you're answering that, you might as well tell me why it's not actually a henge.
The first mention of the name Stonehenge goes way back. And in fact, it's the very first mention of Stonehenge in any context at all. And that is in 1130, when Henry of Huntingdon called it, I don't know how he pronounced it, but it's spelt Stanenges. So it's Stanenges. There's no H in there. Now, what's interesting about that is that that essentially is Anglo-Saxon for stone hanging. And hanging has traditionally been interpreted as referring to the horizontal lintels up in the sky, you know, these great stones hanging in space. However, there's another possibility that this could refer to real hanging, i.e. execution. Some decades ago, I tracked down a skeleton, a human skeleton, that had been excavated at Stonehenge in the 1920s, that we thought had been destroyed in the Blitz. Unfortunately, it had survived, and when we examined it, we discovered it wasn't contemporary with Stonehenge. It wasn't Neolithic, as we had believed, but was in fact Anglo-Saxon. And this poor man had actually been beheaded with a sword and buried very close to the monument, round about 700-800 AD. So there's a possibility that in Anglo-Saxon times, the site of Stonehenge became associated with execution, which could be beheading or hanging. And interestingly, the trilithons, the three really big stones where you've got a single lintel supported by two uprights, is similar to the appearance of an Anglo-Saxon gallows, which is not a single upright with a horizontal timber sticking out sideways, but is two uprights supporting a timber. And so it could be that when Henry of Huntingdon called Stonehenge Stanenges, he was actually using a phrase that had become attached to the monument from a description of it as stone gallows.
That's fascinating. And what about this idea about it not being a henge?
We start off with Stonehenge. Stanenges became Stonehenge. The original word, as we know it, Stanenges, became Stonehenge. And early in the last century, a British Museum archaeologist writing about Neolithic monuments used the word Stonehenge to introduced what he described as a new class of monument that archaeologists had recognised, and he dropped the stone because none of these others had stones, they were just earthworks, and called them henges. It's still a really useful word. It's suitably vague because we've no idea what it really means, and it's applied to late Neolithic, early Copper Age monuments where you have circular enclosures, usually earthworks, ditches and banks, typically with a ditch on the inside of the bank, which is a weird thing if you think about it, because normally earthworks like this are built the other way around because they're there to defend people on the inside, but not always on the outside. And interesting, Stonehenge itself, the earthwork there, has the ditch on the outside. So if you're being really nerdy, Stonehenge itself is not a henge. But henges also have arrangements of posts and sometimes stones. And it's a really handy term for this sort of bunch of clearly partly religious monuments that are circular, that include posts and stones and earthworks that are built around this time in the late Neolithic.
Kenny Brophy, who is a prehistorian, I think himself a prehistoric archaeologist, asking a bit of a leading question. Do you think it is now time for a Stonehenge research moratorium that would allow time, money, intellectual effort and resources to be directed at neglected areas of British prehistory?
That's an interesting question. I think my answer to that, of course, as a Stonehenge nerd, is no, I don't think there should be a moratorium on Stonehenge, but neither do I think that researching Stonehenge or researching the rest of the British Isles or anything at all are two alternatives. These are things that go together. Stonehenge is part of a religious, ritual, social landscape that spread across Europe. And I think the idea that somehow we can research that landscape and not put Stonehenge in it is just silly. I understand where you're coming from because quite often on television and in the media, Stonehenge is portrayed as the centre of the universe as if nothing was happening anywhere else in Europe at the time. And of course, this is nonsense. And I would completely agree with you that that is a picture that we need to change. But there is a surprising amount, huge amount, that we don't know about Stonehenge that we could, with suitable research, learn about. And I really think continuing to do that is an important thing.
Okay, and then another question sort of follows from that, I think, from Tim Dorr, who wants to know, what is it about Stonehenge that suggests to people that some external help, whether Mycenaean, alien or glacial, was needed rather than acknowledge the skill and effort of the builders?
That's a good question, because it is absolutely true that this has long been a feature of Stonehenge history and archaeology. And not just Stonehenge, of course, but, you know, the same thing happens with Easter Island, with pyramids and so on. And it fundamentally, it's patronising and insulting, not just to ancient people, but I would argue also to modern people. The misapprehension goes back to a concept of ancient people as savage and primitive and wild. And when you have something like Stonehenge suddenly popping up in this wild landscape, you have to go somewhere else to explain its presence. And to be honest, whether it's alien or Mycenaean, it's much the same thing, because Mycenaeans are just as alien to the landscape of Wiltshire as somebody from Mars. And it reflects a gross misunderstanding of ancient societies and early humanity. The idea that people who built Stonehenge were not our equals needs to be squashed. The idea that people anywhere in the world or any time were not the equal of people who benefited from Western civilization needs to be squashed. The statues on Easter Island, the megaliths at Stonehenge, were supreme achievements of sophisticated societies. You could take away Stonehenge, you could take away the statues, but you're still left with sophisticated societies, with clever people doing creative things. People in the past were as clever as we are. They had different technologies, they had different beliefs, they had very different ways of living, different histories and so on. But they are people as every bit as sophisticated as us and deserve the same respect that we expect.
That was Mike Pitts. His book, How to Build Stonehenge, is published now by Thames and Hudson. The British Museum exhibition, The World of Stonehenge, is also running now. And you can also find a feature by Mike on the building of Stonehenge in the March issue of BBC History magazine. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us on the History Extra website this week as we dig into the history and mystery of Stonehenge in our special Stonehenge-themed week. With a 30-day free trial to our digital subscription, you can access exciting Q&As featuring Stonehenge experts, quizzes, opinion articles, and more. For a full week of history that you certainly won't want to miss, visit historyextra.com/join. That's historyextra.com/join for more information.